Coming up, an American Muslim leader on the U.S. strategy to combat ISIS. Also, as racial tensions continue in Ferguson, Missouri, Dan Lothian reports on clergy in Boston remembering their own experiences with urban unrest, their successes and failures. And Lucky Severson on prehistoric stone circles, not only at Stonehenge, but perhaps also in Southwest Virginia.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As the nation marked the 13th anniversary of 9/11 with somber ceremonies to remember the victims, ongoing terrorism concerns dominated public attention. In his address to the nation, President Obama outlined an expanded strategy to combat the militant group known as ISIS or ISIL. But he stressed this should not be viewed as a battle against Islam.
ISIL is not Islamic. No religion condones the killing of innocents. And the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslim.
A broad coalition of U.S. Muslim leaders came together to underscore their condemnation of terrorism and extremism. They outlined new efforts to ensure that ISIS and other groups do not gain footholds among young American Muslims.
We will continue to reiterate that the actions of these groups has no basis in the teachings of Islam. Terrorism in all its form is un-Islamic.
Meanwhile, religious freedom activists held a summit in Washington to raise concerns about the persecution of Christians across the Middle East by ISIS and others. The top leaders of some of the region's ancient churches described what they called the ethnic and religious cleansing taking place against their people.
As an international community, as those who have any faith, any sense of moral, any sense of ethics, any sense of right or wrong, we cannot by any means sit by and just look.
Joining me now are Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, and Horace Tureen, the director of the Washington Office of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Horace, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What is your, I know you have some concerns about the president's policy. What is your biggest concern?
The biggest concern is that it not only be a military response and approach to ISIS. It has to be a social, an economic, and an education-based response. There are, Bob, there are 6.1 million internally displaced Syrian refugees in Jordan and various countries around the region, and 50% of them are children. These individuals are ripe for being brainwashed by ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and we must respond to threats like that as well.
But why is it up to us? There are lots and lots and lots of Muslims in the Middle East. Why can't they do it?
Well, I think we have to work with our Middle Eastern partners. But I think America has to take leadership on this issue because we have the ability to really bring the people together in the region. A lot of times, the various countries within the regions have different agendas where they can't come together and really find an overarching goal to address ISIS. And so our leadership is critical. And I think that one thing that the president said, which was important, was we will work with other countries in the region.
Well, if they come forward and want to work with us. Right?
I hope so. And I hope that they're taking this threat seriously because it is a real threat to the people of the region.
What about from the religious perspective? What's the responsibility, the role for U.S. Muslims in this, you know, in a non-governmental way?
Right. I think what U.S. Muslims are doing and their feeling is that ISIS, again, has hijacked their faith. We saw this on 9/11. We saw this repeatedly with Al-Qaeda. ISIS is, again, using our religion to put forth political and social goals in the region. And I think American Muslims are coming out in staggering numbers. Their leadership across the country has come out saying that this does not represent us, this is not who we are, and we will stand against you using our faith to push a political agenda in the region.
Is there something, though, the community can do beyond just words? You know, is there something concrete, maybe, to stop this?
Yes. Communities around the country are making sure that the internet is not a place where young people are being influenced, because the message of ISIS is black and white. It says the West in America is at war with Islam. And so what our communities are doing, our institution has launched a program called Safe Spaces, where we are making sure that our young people are civically engaged and are not vulnerable to the black and white message of ISIS and groups like it.
Do you think that this new policy of the United States can work? Can it really be carried out? Or is there a danger that it really will inspire a lot of Muslims to think that this is the West against Islam and not participate?
That's why, Bob, I mentioned that it cannot be a military response only. If it is a military response, it can potentially make things worse on the ground, because ISIS, unfortunately, actually, runs or rules land the size of Maryland. And what we have to do is make sure that we approach this in a comprehensive manner, socially, economically, and with partners on the ground.
Our time is up. I'm sorry. Many thanks to you, Horace, and
thank
Kim.
You.
In other news, accusations that Israel committed war crimes during its 50-day war in Gaza. The group Human Rights Watch said Israel unlawfully attacked three UN-run schools in Gaza and killed Palestinian civilians. The UN Human Rights Council is also looking into whether war crimes were committed. Israel's military said it would conduct its own investigation. Meanwhile, a delegation of 18 U.S. Catholic bishops is currently on a Holy Land pilgrimage, praying for lasting peace. Catholic sisters called Nuns on the Bus are hitting the road again this coming week, this time to speak out against the role of big money in elections. The nuns have gone on similar tours over the past few years to draw attention to income inequality and immigration reform. This year, they're trying to fight the influence of large, undisclosed campaign contributions. They're mobilizing low-income voters ahead of this year's midterm elections and will visit 36 cities in 10 key battleground states. A well-known Christian student organization has been denied official recognition on the nearly two dozen college campuses in the California State University system. The Evangelical InterVarsity Christian Fellowship requires its leaders to affirm specific Christian beliefs, a policy that effectively bars from leadership those who disagree. The Cal State system says the requirement violates its non-discrimination policy and that official student groups must open leadership to all. InterVarsity says changing the requirement would compromise its religious beliefs. Secular activists were at the Supreme Court in Capitol Hill this week raising concerns about the wall of separation between religion and government. The Secular Coalition for America led demonstrations against recent Supreme Court decisions, including the Hobby Lobby ruling, which they believe allow religion to encroach on the state. They expressed their concern with a symbolic wall of separation that was sewn from 1,600 knitted bricks collected from supporters across the country. As racial tensions continued this week in Ferguson, Missouri, there was widespread discussion of the underlying causes there and in other communities. Correspondent Dan Lothian spoke with clergy in Boston who remember their own involvement, their successes and failures in trying to overcome urban unrest.
In Boston's gritty inner city, Reverend Eugene Rivers,
what's up, baby? How you doing, player?
Is driven by optimism, one more life rescued from the streets.
See, only faith gives you the ability to look at a mountain
and see it as an opportunity. For people without faith, a mountain is an obstacle. For people with the eyes of faith, a mountain's an opportunity.
Boston once had a very big volcanic mountain that erupted in the late 80s and early 90s. An epidemic of murder, some called it, more than 150 victims in 1 year alone. There was no trust between the community and cops. It was a time of guns, gangs, and drugs. This Harvard-educated minister moved into what he calls ground zero and quickly learned about street justice.
He jumps out, pow, pow, pow.
A young gang member, angry at the minister's efforts to clean up a trouble spot, fired shots into his home. Rivers and his family were inside, but were unharmed.
That was a real moment.
No, it was a real test.
It was a test for the city as well. Like the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, mistrust and anger collided in Boston. Law enforcement was failing, even refusing to admit that gangs were in town.
There appeared to be no rules. And the politicians, the secular politicians, had no idea what to do with something which, in their historical memory, had no precedent.
Then, against all odds, the shadow of Boston's big mountain began to fade. Reverend Rivers, along with other inner-city ministers, founded the 10-Point Coalition, an organization that targets at-risk youth. They also began laying the foundation for trust between skeptical residents and the police.
It didn't happen overnight. Little by little, Boston started chipping away at its crime rate. More police officers hit the streets. But part of the solution was the church, pastors who spent more time out on the streets than they did behind the pulpit.
Reverend Bruce Wall, then a youth pastor, who often teamed up with Rivers, started hanging out at Chez Vu, a roller skating rink that at the time was popular with gang members. He was aiming for their minds and their souls.
My wife would watch the TV news and say, oh, a fight broke out again at Chez Vu roller skating rink. And she said, ay, ay, ay. But I was earning credibility at the skating rink.
By 1999, Boston's murder rate had dropped by nearly 80%. The police department was more ethnically diverse. Federal dollars started pouring in, a recognition that the partnership with law enforcement and clergy was working. Reverend Rivers landed on the cover of Newsweek magazine. God versus gangs, it read. That story proclaimed the power of religion as the hottest idea in crime fighting. The turnaround was dubbed the Boston Miracle. In the wake of what happened in Ferguson, veterans of Boston's inner city ministries are reassessing their past.
When you look back 20, 25 years ago, what worked?
The partnerships. Clergy doing street patrols at night, working in collaboration with law enforcement, giving young gang-involved members options, right? Listen, I got a carrot and I got a stick. You figure it out. The clergy, minister, mentor, monitor. That was new.
Rivers, who recently visited Ferguson, says disaffected men need to be reached early.
What Ferguson could learn from Boston is that the clergy have to engage the young brothers. You don't catch a kid at 13 and 14 now. That's too late. You got to get a kid 4, 5, 6, 7 in the hood.
And ministers or other activists, he says, shouldn't just visit but live among them.
Ferguson has to do the churchmen. The clergy of Ferguson, they got to talk to the dudes that threw those canisters back at the police. They've got to reach out to those alienated young men who are very angry, and rightfully so.
And the churches have to be willing to put pressure on lawmakers and police when they aren't doing their jobs.
I'm Pastor Bruce Wall. I'm going to be your host tonight.
Reverend Wall's Boston Praise Radio and TV is an outlet to do just that, hold officials accountable.
We want to bring them in here and put their backs up against the wall and say to them, we don't work for you, you work for us. What is it that you say you're going to do? And then we hold them accountable with a microphone. We're going to be talking about Ferguson, Missouri, why they are not as politically active as they should be.
Wall says he isn't criticizing the people of Ferguson, just having a constructive conversation. Boston, he warns, should not gloat.
People remember what Boston did in the past. Boston is living off of the success of the past. If somebody were to pull the curtain and see that the emperor has no clothes on, we would be exposed for what we are.
He's talking about what Boston did not get right. Pastors and other community activists started bickering over federal dollars for their programs. Partnerships unraveled. And
pastors started traveling all over the country and around the world talking about the success in Boston. The problem was that it left nobody in Boston to continue the success.
Reverend Rivers says the biggest misstep was the lack of foresight, not looking beyond the victory.
We had not developed a succession plan to find younger clergy who would put boots on the ground. One has to take a long view and have a succession plan as part of your model if you're going to sustain it over a longer period of time.
Crime ticked up again, but nowhere near the epidemic of more than two decades ago. Even so, Reverend Wall will soon travel to Chicago, a city confronting its violent crime problem, not to give officials and clergy advice, but to see if there are any ominous trends that could be transmitted to Boston.
I do not want all of this work to be reversed.
Hey, dear. How are you? Fine, how are you?
Rivers still walks these familiar streets, calling out names, pointing to young men he first met when they were in diapers. But there's a new twist. He's also strolling online.
We've got to be at the park, and we've got to try to track Facebook to see what kinds of things are going on. There's been a technological revolution, and people are buying drugs off the internet. They're texting, they're emailing, right? So the cats doing the doo-wop thing on the corner has shifted. Because now, the social network world is the new street corner.
Adjusting to the times in a fight against crime now designed for the long haul. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Dan Lothian in Boston.
There was news this week about Britain's famous prehistoric monument at Stonehenge. Apparently, it's surrounded by at least 17 other similar rock shrines. Around the world, scientists report thousands of prehistoric stone circles, many of them thought to have spiritual significance. Lucky Severson visited one recently discovered such site in southwestern Virginia.
In the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, Chris comes with Clouds White, who is of Cherokee descent, and Jack Reniski, a retired archaeologist, have found something which could turn out to be monumental. Evidence of a prehistoric native population in North America.
In this circle, flows around this way.
Evidence that, for Chris, has a strong spiritual meaning.
I think it happened for a reason that we found it.
When I was building the house, I'd take a break from working up there, come down and sit by the creek. And a small, still voice came to me and said, the land is important. And I've always kept that in my mind. And now I know why. Coming around the circle.
What Chris found were stone circles, which are difficult to see at first. Archaeologist Reniski says when the stones were originally put in place, this area was all grassland.
Go ahead and stand on that. It's easier to see the circles when you get in the center of it. You'll see, first of all, one circle here around you, tight. Mm-hmm. Then another circle, a little further out. And then another circle, further out from that.
Chris and his wife, Renee Whitefeather, both believe that the circles they see on their property are an important connection that's basic to their spiritual tradition.
There's a circle, but there's always a center to every circle. And at that moment, what I was thinking about was, we believe Creator God is in the center.
Ever since the discovery, Reniski has been convinced that this is a very, very old and very significant site.
When we start studying these and mapping these various features, we suddenly discover, hey, these are not random. The humans stacked these rocks in this place. Mother Nature didn't create them.
Reniski sent a small section of jasper, a quartz-like stone that appeared to have been burned in a fire, to a lab for luminescence dating, which is considered by many to be the most reliable form of dating. The lab results seemed to confirm his suspicion. The jasper was apparently worked on 10,470 years ago, making it thousands of years older than any other find in North America.
I published back in the 70s that people were in Virginia 25,000 years ago. And you believe my colleagues said, oh, Jack, you've been tipping this bottle again. It's taken me 50 years to get to this spot.
Dr. Ed Krupp is the director and curator of the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles.
Am I surprised that some kind of structured monument is that old in North America? I would say, yeah, I am, because I don't know anything else that is that old.
Astronomer Krupp is considered an expert in archaeoastronomy and has visited over 2,000 ancient and prehistoric sites worldwide. He says if the Shenandoah site checks out, it would be important.
We're actually beholden to all of these ancestors all around the planet. They are the people that help make our world the way it is for us today, whether we're in China, North America, Europe, or whatever.
Renee Whitefeather is from the Lumbee tribe of North Carolina.
We're reluctant sometimes to say we are owners, we own a paleo Indian site. We don't want to say that because we feel like it's something we're custodians of.
Us all being related by virtue of being created and respecting that is, that represents a circle. The circle of life that we're born, we have a youth, we get old, we die, but we believe that there's something beyond that where our ancestors are. So that's a circle.
Stone circles and prehistoric sites have been discovered right across the globe. In West Africa, Egypt, Ireland. In fact, throughout the British Isles, there are hundreds of stone circles. And then, of course, there is Stonehenge, the granddaddy of them all, which was built around 3000 BC. And like all of these prehistoric sites, who put them there and why, we really don't know.
I don't think you're ever going to have a confident sense of certainty about the prehistoric past and prehistoric monuments for the obvious reason. We don't have the owner's manual.
Reniski says from this rock, it's possible to see the summer and winter solstices marked out clearly, and both the spring and fall equinox.
When we first discovered this, it didn't take long till I knew that sun was coming up over that part. I knew the equinox was there. I had already measured the site as an absolute east-west orientation.
It's difficult to imagine that this Virginia site was created by nature. Also difficult to understand how humans could stack these boulders in place. The stones sitting on top appear to have been crafted by human hands. The bottom boulder alone would weigh as much as 2,000 pounds.
If you look right here, you'll notice that this is shimmed to make it level. This bottom rock is milled flat. It's not natural, it's milled flat. And to get this level, to get the elevation they wanted, they had to shim it, which is amazing.
Somebody had it in his head, the technology, the astronomical physics of this planet, to be able to come out here and say, okay, let's move these things around so this does this particular thing. I want to make a clock out of this.
At noon every day, it doesn't matter if it's summer, spring, winter, this channel will illuminate at noon. It looks like we have a couple minutes to go. It starts to illuminate, 10 minutes, 12 minutes before, then as the sun passes this way, it's in that channel.
And lo and behold, 10 or 12 minutes, the sun passes through the channel. The connection this could represent between ancient peoples and the universe they observed around them strikes a spiritual chord with Renee White.
When people come here, they feel an incredible positive energy here when they come. They feel good vibrations.
Each group of people is culturally very distinctive. They're going to do things their way for their reasons. But the broad picture behind this is an attempt to integrate human behavior to the cosmos, the greater cosmos. That's really what sacred space is. That's why we get geometry and astronomical alignment built into it.
Chris Comes With Clouds and Renee Whitefeather have expressed their deepening spirituality by starting a church that meets periodically under the trees by the stones. Anyone can attend. The Whites feel an obligation to share what they consider to be a sacred site. Archaeologist Jack Berniski plans to share his findings with his professional colleagues for peer review in the upcoming months. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson reporting.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more and where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you this weekend of the 200th anniversary of the Star-Spangled Banner, the Georgia Baptist All-State Choir sings the national anthem at Fort McHenry, Maryland.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.